Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I dagens episode av ukens podcast har vi besøk av en legende. En legende som har vært med å skape tysk vinindustri. Han har egenhåndig stått i vinmarka brattere enn Holmenkoll, kanskje aller mer brattere. Han har bygget opp to store brand i Norge, og alle nordmenn har på en eller annen måte hatt et forhold til dette navnet og denne merkevaren. Og det er en ære, og det er en veldig hyggelig tid her i studio. Men vi har Ernst Losen på besøk. Welcome, Ernst, to the studio.
Thank you for the invitation, Svein. Very nice of you.
One of the thing when we heard that you was coming to Norway was I was looking to old pictures. And I was explaining a little bit about your vineyards, and we'll come back to that and how Mosel have been racing up from something to something new. You have told the story many times. We know the story. But Ernst, what is the situation today in Mosel in the industry of wine? If you are thinking a little bit outside the box of your own company, but where are this after the pandemic and where is it now?
Well, you know, I mean, the Mosel belongs to one of the 13 wine-growing regions of Germany. It's the third largest wine-growing region of Germany, you know, after Pfalz, Palatinate, and Rheinhessen, you know. The Mosel was always famous for Riesling since 150 years. You know, it's the grape variety for the Mosel. And, well, you know, I think with each generation, it has his favorites, you know. It's like, you know, wine is also mode, you know. It's fashion, you know. And so, as it used to be, the Mosel was very famous for the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s for their fruity style wines, which I still love very much, you know. The typical fruity Cabernet, Spätlese, Auslese, you know, the fruity style. There was no dry wines really much produced in the Mosel because it was before global warming. Things have been not so ripe. The dry wines could be a little bit austere, a little bit acidic, you know, possibly not as pleasant as what the South could do for dry wines. But to be frank, you know, the global warming helped us as the most northern growing wine region in this size of Europe, you know, helped us to produce suddenly great dry wines. And I think this is the biggest transformation in the last 20 years, you know, that we moved more from the fruity style wines, which I still adore because I think no other region in Germany or in the world can do so light, delicious, delicate, fruity style wines like a fruity Cabernet with a little bit of residual sweetness or fruity Spätlese. No?
Because what you're talking about is the matching between sugar and
acidity. Yes, exactly.
And I remember when I was visiting for some years ago, you told me that the balance between sugar and acidity is something it takes a lifetime to achieve the perfect balance.
Yeah. Well, at least you need, I mean, you learn it through experience, you know, through as more years you're doing winemaking, you know, you get a feeling, you know, what vintage should have, what a cabinet should have here and, you know, on residual sweetness. And it always depends on the acidity, you know. The acidity is the major, you know, ingredients, you know, to find out, you know, how you balance out the acidity. But, as I said, but we saw in the last 20 years, you know, a strong move towards dry wines, you know. But I think the Mosel needed a little bit more time to learn to make great dry wines because we never produced dry wines, you know. So the Pfalz of the South, of Rheinhessen or Baden, you know, they had a 20 years longer experience for that, you know.
But maybe also have got a reputation of other types of wine. So
yeah, they had also other grape varieties, you know. We always have been working with Riesling, huh? But we see there is a strong move to dry Rieslings from the Mosel. And the dry Rieslings from the Mosels, you know, and nowadays you have really fantastic wines, they're dry wines, you know, because there's always a little bit more minerally driven, you know. They seem to age better, you know, because of the longer hang time, you know, and the little bit higher minerality of acidity and all these things, you know, it seems to, we can really make now great dry wines in the Mosel with great ageability, which can age, you know, that is also very important.
So what you're saying is that Mosel could be the next go-to place, even if you're producing wine there. I mean, if there are only 20 years of revolution of this to dryness, and then you can see, okay, now we have learned, hopefully, and then you can say the next 20, 30 years will be then generation two of Mosel of quality.
I mean, I think we're already there. Yeah. You know? We're already there. I mean, I would say the prices, there's no.
The prices have not gone up so much. No, so it's not.
We
so
are not yet there. That's true. Yeah. We are not that year there where our colleagues are from the south, you know, from south of Germany, you know. So that's true. We are not yet there, you know. But I think it's only a question of time that we will keep up.
Yeah. No, but we see that in Norway. As you know, Norway is, have been for many years. Almost 20 years have been a great country for Riesling, and almost only Riesling. And I read some numbers last night that it was on the top 500 list. It was top 500 list. It was 33 Rieslings.
33 Rieslings.
And you are number 14 of best selling.
Oh, wow.
So that's good.
Yeah,
and
that's
you have been there for many years.
That's good, yes.
Around, I think it's around 600,000 bottles. No, liters. It's a lot. But the flood of Riesling is a little bit, there are so many brands, so many wines, and so many, so it's a bit overflowed with Riesling. And that's, I think it's, could be a very bad thing that it is too much Riesling. And it's less Spätburgunder, it's less Pinot Noir, and so on. But for me, Mosel have been always the easy drinking, the light weighted. But I also taste your wines, and it's coming, of course, more concentrated and so on. And that's one of the topics I want to take up today, is that for Norwegian, because of the most selling brands, they are looking on a brand, but there are some other wines behind it.
Oh, yeah.
Who's just in amazing shape. Yeah. And we will come back to that. You have brought with you two fantastic wines from the vintage of 2021.
21, yes.
And then you have the fantastic property of Villa Wolf, who is one of the, my favorites of Pinot Noir in that price segment.
Yes.
It's good. But let's go back to Mosel, Ernst. When did your story start in Mosel?
Well, my personal story started when I took over the family business. Yeah. That was in 1988, 1st of January 1988. I took over the wine, the family business, you know, which is a typical family business in the Mosel, 200 years in the family, you know. So in 1988, 1st of January, I took over from my father, you know, from my dad, you know. Which is also now, oh my God.
It's
34 years ago, you know, so I'm getting an old donkey
but
here.
But if you go back to that time, your family business was then producing much more wine. You have the heritage of vineyards was 6 hectares?
No, 10 hectares.
10 hectares, days, yes.
No, it was smaller than nowadays. Yes. You know, I took over 10 hectares, which was in these days big for the Mosel. The Mosel was always a region with small estates, you know. So the average size in these days, you know, was 1.5 hectare, you know, of a winery. That was the average size, you know. But this doesn't work nowadays anymore. You can't make a living anymore from 1.5 hectare. So you need it. For 10 hectares in these days was already big, you know, but not anymore today, you know. So we are much bigger now. I've bought in the last 30 years a lot of vineyards, you know, because the opportunity was there, you know, a lot of...
So it was 10 hectares when you started, and the situation today is how much?
It's 60.
60, yeah.
60.
But could you describe for our listeners how the landscape are? Because it's breathtaking. And I will take some picture I'd taken there, because this is...
Well, it's
this is
deep.
Not,
it's deep. It's a... It's along the river, you know, the steep slopes along the river, and and the Mosel is the wine region, in the only wine region in the world, which also has the steepest vineyard in the world, the Prémacalmont. Yeah. You know, Prémacalmont is supposed to be the steepest vineyard in the world.
And in numbers, do you know what the numbers is? Are they are 45 or?
Oh no, 68. No.
68.
68. Yeah. Well, that is.
That's
like this, you know. I mean, that is.
You
I
have
mean,
to climb.
Breathtaking, you know, to look down there. And we just, I mean, I had been jumping into this adventure, you know, 3 years ago, and bought 1.1 hectare in the Prémacalmont, exclusively the Le Die Belcadet, you know. So we have exclusively the Le Die Belcadet, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I was not drunk. I don't know. I don't know what drove me to buy it, but I thought such a vineyard, you know, a vineyard which is called the steepest vineyard in the world, you know.
Yeah.
That is so, I mean, something so, I mean, einmalig, something so singular, you know.
Yeah.
So you have to take it. It was the chance to buy it, you know. And so we did three vintages now there, you know. Yeah. And it is amazing. Really, it's an totally new experience for me.
Yeah.
Extremely new experience, you know, because I thought after 34 years, you know everything, you know?
Yeah.
No. I mean, you learn every year again and again something new and something new. And the, the Calmont, the Belcadet, which we have exclusively, you know, it's amazing. It's all again, you know, what you thought, you know, learning by doing. Then you find out.
Hmm. Yes. So you think you're still learning by doing, but you have some experience for Mosel, and I've tested your wines for almost 20 years.
Sure.
And so there is no lack of quality. It's more that you improve something every year, and also you probably
And push it forward.
You
know,
push it forward.
Push. You know, to try to find out not new things, not experimental things. You know, I want to find out the days of the great days of German Riesling, you know, of Mosel and Rhine Riesling, which was around 1900 when Riesling from Rhine and Mosel had been the most expensive wines in the world, 2 to 3 times more expensive as first growth clarets like Chateau Latour, Margaux, no, Lafitte, you know, 2 to 3 more expensive, you know. What did they do in these days, you know?
Yeah, but was that of tasting quality or all of?
Also winemaking. I mean, like tasting winemaking, you know? So, I mean, you know, to find, you have to find out what did they do these days, you know? I mean, you know, we forgot it. That is 120 years ago, 130 years ago. We forgot so many things.
Mm.
That is always said, these are the days where the people didn't have a lot of time, but no technology.
Yeah.
Nowadays, we have a lot of technology, but no time, you know?
Yeah.
And the winemaking in these days, and this I'm working now since 25, 30 years on this, to find out how they made the wines in these days and what made them so great. And I tell you, and that is, what we're tasting here, GG, our GG Reserve, is exactly made as my great-grandfather made wine 120 years ago, between 1880 and 1930, you know, where he kept the wines, you know, 2 to 8 years in the barrel on the full yeast, no wrecking, you know? And so, and that is amazing. Our GG Reserves, you know, it's a totally different animal. I totally understand now. I mean, I do this now, since 20 years, you know? And if I taste these GG Reserves, which are made in this very old-fashioned style, you know, they are fantastic. They're even after 20 years, they're still young. I mean, these people knew things, you know, which we sadly forgot after the filter was invented. Sure, with the filter, you didn't have to wait anymore. Why they people kept the wine 2-3 years in the barrel in these days? Because there was no filters, there was no fining. They had to wait until the wines clarified themselves, until the wines finding itself, you know, until they find natural balance, you know, and was clear until they could start to bottle. These people knew what does 2 or 3 or 4 years of barrel aging does to the wine. We don't know this anymore because now we filter and bottle, you know? So that has been all gone lost. And I now, since 20 years, it's not experimenting anymore because I'm doing these wines now, you know? Seriously, and every year.
Mm.
But I tell you, but still, every year we see the fine-tuning. We find out, yeah. oh, here and there, and this a little bit there, you can make yeah. a better wine. But this is so amazing, you know? It's yeah. so amazing to find out.
So you think you have more and more steps, because the mm. wine yields are getting older, mm. you, mm. Yields are going probably a little bit down,
yeah.
And you're learning a little bit more of this process of mm. small tuning.
Yeah.
But from the other side, I feel that you and other ones are getting more saltiness in the end. It's getting more concentrated. It's the acidity is strong. It's long living, and it's a kind of concentration. You have to learn. Use some time to learn it, because if you take it at once, too young, like now, the 2021. People are drinking German Riesling in Norway too early, or many of them, and that's
not only
too
in Norway,
bad.
Not only in Norway.
yeah, yeah. but could you imagine that this potential of showing old wines are our own segment in the future? Because if you're saying, okay, German Riesling 10 years old is fresh.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is exactly what I do.
Hmm.
I produce wines. I mean, sure, I release wines young, but I produce 50, 60,000 bottles every year, which I put 10, 20 years away before I release it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, that is my goal, you know. I mean, producing wines first in the old historic style, when these people in these days, my grandfather never drank a Riesling when it was not minimum 15, 20 years old. They drank it only old, like Clarets, you know.
Yeah.
And so... And that is what I do. I put 50, 60,000 bottles away. We just released 3 years ago our 97 Würzgarten Spätlese, or 98, 25 years old. We released them, you know?
Yeah.
And so I do homage, you know? I mean, or our reserve wines, you know? They are 2 years in the barrel and then 4 years in the bottle before I start releasing them. The homage, we call it homage, you know? Our homage stays 3 years in the barrel on the full yeast. And then after bottling, another 10 years in the bottle before we release it, you know? And we have wines which my great-grandfather, he kept his most favorite barrels. He kept 8 years in the barrel on the full yeast. 8 years in the barrel on the full yeast. And then another 7 years in the bottle before he released it. I do all these things, you know? So we do this because I think... In the future, there will be a big demand for that again, you know? People will discover the great quality which is behind this old winemaking, you know? And we use, by the way, only for this kind of top wines like the GG Reserve, you know, or Homage, you know? We use only vineyards which are on their own roots, uncrafted, own roots, no American rootstocks, and which are minimum 100 and more years old. You know? Only from our top vineyards, which are extremely old on their own roots, you know, and that is, I mean, they have this Milrondage fruit, you know, where there's this little tiny berries, you know. I mean, it's unbelievable. That's fantastic, you know. That is so.
But to
so
break it a little bit down in numbers, because people understand, okay, highly concentrated. But for me, it's a little bit. I always explain that.
I call it more complex as concentrated.
How many hours do you use for your top wines to produce and collect grapes and everything, compared to No, like the Villa Wolf Pinot Noir here. To have 1 liter of the top quality wine, how much hours do you use, do you think?
Well, I mean, the whole thing starts in the vineyard, you know?
Hmm.
I mean, the biggest process, you know, or the most intense process is the selection in the vineyard. But after that, it is the normal winemaking with everything. It is because I don't have to work very hard if I keep a wine 8 years in the barrel, you know?
No.
The only thing you have to do is top it up
regularly.
Yeah. Every month, top it up. Keep always the barrel full. Never, you know, topping up, that is very important, you know? But that is the good thing, you know, if you do, I mean, this is wine, I mean, it's serious winemaking, but you need only patience here. Yeah. It's not much work.
You use more man-hour to collect and work with
with the harvest, you know.
Yeah.
With the harvest, you have to do the selection, you know.
Yeah.
So we select more this Milrondage fruit and this, and you know.
Mm.
The most intense, for my opinion, the most intense process is the harvest. The harvest, hand harvest with 3-4 different buckets, and then you do the selections, the different types of grape you select into the different buckets. That slows down the process. I mean, give you an example. We all our pickers have three buckets, you know, a black bucket, a red bucket, and a little white bucket, you know. It's all hand harvested. In the black bucket, they do only the 100% healthy grapes. In the red bucket, they put the medium botrytis ice grapes, the medium noble rotten grapes, so 50% noble rot, 50% healthy grapes. They put in the red bucket, that is for the noble sweet Auslese. And the fully botrytis ice, fully shriveled noble rotten grapes, you know, no healthy grapes for that. They cut this out and put it in the little white bucket, you know. So if we go for the full selection, you know, with 40 people, we can do 40 people. We're talking about that. That's an investment of 4,010 carriers, you know. It's basically 40 picking, 10 people who are carrying, 50 people. That's an investment for the whole day for 1 hectare of 5,000 euros. Wow. If you take a harvesting machine, you know, a harvesting machine is 800 euros for a hectare.
Yeah.
And they do the hectare in 45 minutes for 800 euros. I need 9 hours with 50 people for 1 hectare, and that cost me 5,000 euros. Okay. So you see, this is the biggest investment, is the selective harvest. Selective harvest.
Yeah, people forget a little bit of that hand work that you're doing also.
That's intense.
Difficult. But how you do collect, how do you find your people? Is coming the same people?
Well, say 80% are the same people. They're mostly from, the Germans don't do this. It's everywhere in the world. Yeah. It's mostly Romanians now. In the old days, it was Polish people. Now it's more Romanian people, you know, more from Romania. Great people. They do very, very dedicated, wonderful people.
But I know that you took your education in Geisheim, and then you have some time in Alsace and California and Burgundy and so on.
Well, not really. I visited all these places with Stuart Pickett days, you know, because I was the driver. He still doesn't have a driver's license, and he visited all these places. And I always said, Stuart, I drive you, you know. So I got the chance to visit all these great places in the world, you know, top producers around the world, you know, by being the chauffeur of a wine journalist.
But through all these years in wine industry, you have been around and taste a lot of other wine.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and I know that you're in love not only with Mosel wine, but you are caring about much other taste. But how important is it for a winemaker today, if you are meeting a young one, to taste wines from all over the world to understand its own quality?
Why should it be different 30 years ago as today? I always says, that's my saying, a great wine starts in your head, you know? First, you need to have an idea what a great wine is. How you want to produce a great wine if you don't have a clue what a great wine is, you know? For example, I can give you a little bit, that's 30 years ago, you know. I have been traveling already, a lot of people. I met Olivier Umbrecht, I met Ravano, I met, you know, the Rousseau, Charles Rousseau, and all these great winemakers in the world, you know. And I have been starting to collect these wines, you know, and these days I liked Bordeaux, you know, Latour. I thought Latour is what great, and so tasted it very often. Had been also visiting Latour every day, every year, you know, and so. And then it was basically my Swedish importer in these days, you know, and he came visited me, you know, and then he said, and I said, oh, let's go for dinner, you know, in the evening. And I said, oh, do you mind if I bring a young winemaker with me, you know, 30 years ago? And so we also imported a little bit of wine off him, you know. I said, yeah, sure. I brought a Chateau Latour with me to dinner, you know, and he brought a red wine, you know, Mosel red wine, you know, Pinot Noir with him for the dinner, you know. And so I opened the Latour, you know, I think it was, I don't know, 91, no, no, 88 Latour. And so the young man said, oh, that's very tannic, you know, and it stings like horse leather. So he described it very well. And then he said, this wine would never get an AP number in Germany. No. And then we opened his wine.
Yeah.
It was a pale red, rather rosé, Pinot Noir, with 40 gram residual sweetness, no malolactic fermentation.
Okay.
And you know what I said? Look, you know, this is not really a great red wine, young man, you know? And he said, no, this is a great red wine. This is a great Pinot Noir, as my father does it, you know? And so, and there I thought myself, this young man never saw anything else in his life, and therefore that he always drank the sweet red wine, you know, or Pinot Noir from his father, he thought this is a great one, no? And so, and that's the reason I always say a great wine starts in your head. First, you need an idea. Yeah. What is a great red wine? Or what is a great white wine? And I don't think that it doesn't matter if it is red or white. What is a great wine? And if you have a certain idea, clear idea of a great wine, then you go and start to producing it. I'm not the guy, the naturalist, you know, and said, oh, God, give me the wine, and I wait, I don't do anything, you know, and, you know, God gives it to me. No. I think you have to make wine. You have to, like education of kids, you know, you have to intervene. You have to do, otherwise, you know, the only thing I know what God is doing with wine is it turns into vinegar, you know?
Yeah.
And I think you have to intervene into winemaking, you know? And that is what I mean. And where you get the idea of making great wine, if you visit all the great winemakers in the world, and it doesn't matter if I did it 40 years ago or if a young man does it nowadays, he needs to taste a lot of great wines to get an idea what a great wine is. And then he can also produce a great wine in his home, you know?
Yeah. And I totally agree with you, Ernst, because this is one of my thing when people, I taste some 1,000 wines a year as a wine journalist.
Yes.
And it's a very nice job, of course, because it's only tasting. But also when I recognize a very good, well-made wine, who's not sweetened up or something, but good connotation, I always ask myself if this is some sort of reference. And after your opinion, for 30 years ago, who was the reference in Moselle? And are there more reference Moselle? If you're going to pick up some of your colleagues, of course yourself, who's the reference in Moselle today compared to old days?
Well, I mean, it depends, you know. I would say if it comes to the fruity style wines, the sweeter style, the traditional Cabernet, but now you have to differentiate, you know, you have to differentiate. Because you can't use somebody as a reference who doesn't produce produce dry wines, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's impossible. Yeah. So therefore that we have these two traditions in the Mosel, you have to take the reference, you know, for these two traditions, you know. And so, I mean, sure, for me, I can only speak for me. In the old days, the reference for the fruity style wines, you know, was always J.J. Prim or Egon Müller, you know. I mean, also for me on the Ruwer, Dr. von Schubert, you know, and Maximilian Krünhaus, you know, was always a reference for me for the sweeter style wines because they made great wines, you know. I mean, if you taste 60s or 70s still from the 60s, 70s, you know, 80s, fantastic wine. But with the dry wines, there was no references because there was nobody who did only concentrate on dry wines. This you had to learn yourself. You had to do your own adventure, your own experiences. Yeah. Huh? And so I took away my own way, you know. And so in this case I was my own reference, you know, because I started it and improved it every year, for my opinion, you know, by
because
improving
you're
it. You're
described as a pioneer of Moselle to dry wines.
Yes,
a lot of money and investments and go through some walls to get what you're today.
I mean, I invested a lot of money. I mean, I've been going totally back to wood. I mean, I possibly invested €1 million only in oak, you know, and I mean, old barrels, traditional fooder barrels, 1,000-3,000 liter big, you know, and so, you know, still not finished, you know. Oh. This is an enterprise which takes 30-40 years. Well, I always say, you know, I still get 100, you know. Yeah. I have another 30 years.
Yeah. Well, we're going to live long, so that's the problem. But if you go to the reference of dry high, who are your friends out there in the Moselle who go the same direction? Because you have lead the Moselle, not only you, but you've been to that path that you probably have a meeting and say, we have to do something about this. And then you're building an industry that now Moselle is respected by a young generation of wine lovers. But today, who will you mention as the top three, four to bring Moselle forward? And are there any producers who is a black sheep? I mean, young and beautiful.
I mean, if it was from the famous, I mean, you know, I must say it was always the wine estate is now sold, Kartäuserhof, you know. Yeah, but in the last 20, 30 years, I must say Christophe Turrell, the owner, you know, he was also definitely the pioneer of with his dry wines from the Kartäuserhof, definitely, you know. They had been every year outstanding, you know, the dry wines of Kartäuserhof, you know. Also Schubert, you know, he's doing sweet wines, but he's also was always, I mean, really, really very nice with his dry wines. But it is a lot of young people, you know, I mean, who are just totally new, you know, in the Mosel, like from me, I mean, Daniel Vollenweider, you know, he came from Switzerland, you know, a totally passionate winemaker, you know, and he learned with us even, you know, he did his apprenticeship with us, you know, and he started then 20, 25 years ago, his own little winery in Traben-Trarbach and bought, because a Grand Cru vineyard, which is Wolfer Goldgrube, it was cheap to buy, you know, all uncrafted wines. He did an amazing job, fruity as dry, you know. So there's a lot of, you know, also newcomers, you know, young, very, you know, dedicated young winemakers, you know, who did are doing a great job here, you know.
Because what we see in Norway, there are, of course, when you started in your wines in, you have imported the wines to Norway for a very long time.
Yes.
But you also see that there are so many brands that it's a little bit disappearing, the new stars or new people. And we are, as journalists, we often go to the old names or the names who was well known. That's why I asked this question, because there's always someone.
Yes.
And even if they are not producing so much or don't have so many hectares, it's nice to see that the area is not closed, as many areas become to be, that there are few owners, but they are not growing. Because in Mosel, you still find very small producers who produce very high
because
quality.
Because like Vollenweider, that's, I mean, it's only three and a half hectares, you know?
And the prices is low. So for me, it's a kind of, I always are open to new producers from Mosel, because I've learned that the hard way, that don't underexpect anyone.
I must say, we never had such a high density of wonderful wines and wonderful producers, small, bigger, whatever, you know. The competition is so much bigger and dense, you know, and intense, you know, as when I started 35 years ago, you know, there was not much competition, you know, that we have been, we have been the pioneers, the people, Dönhoff, you know, and, you know, Robert Weil, me, you know, and, you know, this gang, you know, this old gang, you know, and so, you know, and so, but now, you know, it is, but which is fantastic. Yeah. That's the reason that German wines is coming back, you know, because as more people, competition is good, very good, you know, more of these young people want to know it, you know, want to work hard for making better wine, and there's so many of them, you know, I think Germany never had so many good wines and estates, you know, which really work every year to get better and better and better and better, which is fantastic.
As I'm going to say it to your listeners, you heard that Hans Lusen, she is fantastic here in the studio, but we need to take a little break for the commercial, and we will be back, and then we will taste his three wines, and we're going to taste the beautiful of them. We let the commercial go.
Yes, vi skal ha litt reklame, og vi må jo fortsette å takke Temptec. Det de som gjør denne podcasten mulig, og det er en perfekt sponsor her, fordi det nyttig informasjon, vil jeg si. Og den modellen som vi har lyst til å nevne fra Temptec denne gangen, det denne modellen som de kaller Prestige Pro, som et skap laget for på en måte den typiske samleren, smartphone typiske samleren, men også dere som, og det inkluderer oss, Svein, vi som frustrert over at det ikke plass til champagne I vinskapet ditt. Det har jeg merket det siste. Jeg gjorde den grassale feilen at jeg bestilte et vinskap da jeg bygde om kjøkkenet mitt, og der var det ikke plass til champagneflasker I alle hyllene. Så jeg kjenner meg igjen I dette. Men hyllene I dette skapet til Temptec, de designet for å kunne lagre alle flaskestørrelser fra Bordeaux, Burgund, Champagne, Riesling, men også da enkelte magnumflasker, som en stor fordel. Hvis du skal ha et vinskap, så bør du ha plass til alt mulig. Og så har de denne tingen som jeg nevnt tidligere, som litt unikt med disse Temptec-skapene, det denne label view, så du kan vise frem noen av flaskene dine til deg selv eller gjestene dine. Og så har de selvfølgelig alle de tingene som gjør et vinskap til et vinskap. Stabil temperatur, luftfuktighet, you name it, they have it. Og som vanlig, disse skapene får du eksklusivt hos Power, hvis du interessert I et vinskap. Hvis du ikke fikk et vinskap til jul, ikke vent da til neste jul, vil jeg foreslått. Skaff det nå. Kanskje det januar også. Hva vet jeg? Jeg har ikke peiling. Det fortalte ikke Temptek meg. Men skaff deg et vinskap nå, og vær trygg resten av året. Du vil ikke angre. Hilsen Temptek, og hilsen oss.
Og der vi tilbake igjen. For dere som har begynt å lytte eller kommer tilbake igjen, så har vi nå på besøk Ernst Losen, en av verdens mest berømte vinmakere, som nesten egenhåndig og sammen med veldig få har bygget Mosel I Tyskland til en av de mest respekterte vinområder I verden. And we are back in the podcast, Ernst. We heard before the commercial that we are tasting wines. And we will start with the project of Villa Wolf. And let's yes. start, what is Villa Wolf?
Well, you know, on the Mosel, you know, that's the family estate, which is 200 years in the family since, say, more or less since 200 years, we do only Riesling, you know, which I think is the crepe variety for the Mosel, which works best there, you know. That's like Pinot Noir in Burgundy, or Chardonnay in Burgundy. It's the Riesling for the Mosel, you know. But beside of the Riesling, I must say, I like the Burgundy, the Pinot. Pinot varietals very much, you know. I like Pinot Blanc, I like Pinot Noir, I like Pinot Gris. So it was always my idea before I start to do something in the Mosel, which is traditionally not barely grown there, you know. I rather go to the area, which has a very long tradition for the Pinot varietals. And the Rhine River has a more than 1,000 years of tradition of growing Pinot varietals, the Pinot Blanc and the Pinot Gris and the Pinot Noir. It was, I think, the old French king Charles the Bold who brought the Pinot varietals 1,000 after Christ to the Rhine, to basically to Lake Constance, and then moved up the Rhine, you know. So it is definitely a Rhine varietal, the Pinot. And so I thought, and I got 96, I got this great chance, you know, to take over a very old historic wine estate. Villa Wolf, you know, was founded 1843. It was the perfect place, you know, to say, oh, let's go there. And here we do we do also Riesling there. I mean, you know, yeah. Riesling is the main varietal of Germany, you know. 50% of the world production of Riesling is produced in Germany, you know. But for me, it was also a very important to go there. To go to a place where Pinot has a long tradition. And so in 96, I got the chance to take over the Villa Wolf estate, and we started then doing also, beside of Riesling, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Gris, you know?
Yeah.
And that was the goal, you know? I mean, we do also now a little bit of Pinot Blanc and a little very, very tiny Pinot Noir in the Mosel, you know, but more by accident.
Yeah. But this Pinot Noir we have in the glass here
is
the Pinot Noir of 2020.
20, yeah, 20. That's our Pinot Noir Villa Wolf 2020, you know.
And this Pinot Noir is, for me, is very fruit-driven.
Yes.
But it's more fruit-driven today than it was earlier.
Mm.
Because there have been a little path for my palate to understand Villa Wolf some ways in the
Pinot. Also we learn every year.
Because
we try to improve every year. Yeah. We are not happy. I mean, if you're once happy what you're doing, you know, then you will never improve, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I know it is exponential more work if you know, I mean, the first 50% is easy. Everybody knows how to winemaking, you know? Then the next 20% is exponential more work, you know?
Yeah.
But the last 5%, you know, it is 10 times or 15 times or 20 times more work as the first 50.
Yeah.
But you never reach you never reach the 100 point. Yeah. You try only to get closer and closer and closer to learn more. But I think the most important thing is that you still dry every year. And if it is only a tiny little bit, you know, I mean, to get better, you know, to get better, you know.
Because the pricing of this is only 163 kroner, yes. 64 kroner.
Yeah, that is the funny thing. That's our entry level.
Yeah.
But, you know, isn't it more important often, you know, which I say, you know, I mean, if you have a great vineyard, a fantastic Grand Cru vineyard, you know, and you can do a few barrels there, you know, and to concentrate on this wonderful vineyard and do a great wine. But isn't it much more difficult to produce high quality with the wines, with the entry level wines? And is it not more? Yeah, and is it not even not more important? For me, it is so important to put more effort, you know, also into the entry-level wines. Because you know what I always say? Riesling, our Dr. L. Riesling, for example, that has to be a very good product. Why? Because if people don't know anything about the Mosel, a Mosel Riesling, they, I mean, or don't know anything about Bordeaux, they don't go out and buy for $600 a bottle of Chateau Latour or Mouton Rothschild. They buy the Mouton Cadet for $10 or $12 to taste what Bordeaux is about it. If this wine sucks, he will never go back to Bordeaux again. So you only have this one chance, you know, to convince. For me, the entry-level wine should be always the ambassador for the region. That if people who don't know anything about the region, they buy a $10 bottle of wine from this region. And if they like this wine, they say, oh my God, this seems to be a nice region. They make great wines. And then he possibly go to the next time and buys a $20 bottle of Riesling, you know, and said, oh, really, that's nice. And then he start learning. But if you put him off with the first taste of an entry-level wine, you know, then he's never come back. And therefore, for me, it's important. It doesn't matter if it is our entry-level Pinot Noir or entry-level Riesling. We put so much effort into the entry-level wine because this is my ambassador, you know, my ambassador to higher to higher qualities, you know. And therefore, I think too, we, and you know, funny thing here, the entry level here in wine, you know, well, people always say, it's nice and so, you know, and so, but they think they can't put it away. I found a few weeks ago, I found 120 bottles of this wine, you know. I don't know why.
You're losing bottles? you have to check it out.
Yeah, whatever, you know, yeah. I mean. 2008 vintage, so 14 years old. I opened a bottle and said, hallelujah, holy moly, this entry level, how beautiful the wine was. And then I had in the evening, I had my English importers there, you know, which are a lot of French wines, and so they know a lot, you know. And so I opened this 2008 and poured it to them, you know, pliant, you know, and said, what do you think? This is French, that's Burgundy, no? And so I said, no, that's the entry-level wine you sell to Waitrose, you know, only 14 years old.
Yeah.
And this is, for me, important, that also an entry-level wine has the potential, you know, to age and still shows after age, that it's not a one-shot, you know, fly, you know, that it also has future, you know, that it can also age, you know. And that is, for us, very important, you know, to put a lot of. And here, and nobody does for an entry-level wine for that price. These wines are all over-barreled. It's 18 months, you know. Half of it is 18 months in French oak, you know.
Yeah.
18 months in French oak, used oak, not new oak. Mm. And the other half is 18 months in stainless steel. The idea is behind this. Have it at 18 months in French oak, you know, you get the complexity through the micro-oxidation, through the staves. It gets, the fruit is going away a little bit, but you get much more complex wine. And the wine, the other half, which stays 18 months in stainless steel, you know, keeps the fruit because it can't, you know, oxidize, you know. It keeps the fruit, but still already matures a little bit, comes together, but still keeps the fruit. And then after 18 months, I blend both together. I have the complexity from the oak and the fruit from the stainless steel. And that makes it, you know, still fruit, but the same time complex.
But if you want to describe your own wine, Ernst, how do you... Because for me, this is a fruit-driven, light-bodied red wine with berries. Did have this tannin structure is good, but what I like
it's a bit softer. Always, German Pinot Noirs are always softer in the tannin structure.
Yeah, a little bit softer, but this is also the acidity level here is outstanding good. So it's very good food wine.
Yes.
When you see on the price, this is one of the not expensive, but very good fruit-driven real wines.
Yes.
And I'm very thankful that we took it to the studio.
No, it's very nice. And you know, the beautiful color, you know, for Pinot Noir, everything there, good. You know.
Yeah. Mm. But you have brought also two other wines who is describing more or less your passion of
our
wines.
Flagship wines.
Yeah. And for our listeners... what do we have in the glass now? And please describe a little bit.
Yeah.
Because
yes,
one of the things I recommend to everyone who has not been in Mosul is to travel there. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons is because it's a beautiful, beautiful scenery.
Yes.
And it's dramatical. You can see the weather changed 100 kilometers away. And you can have sunshine. You can see the thunderstorm. Mm-hmm. It's so beautiful, but it's also the quietness because so
yes,
they are so quiet
that there's no industry. You can hear
the, yeah, it's no industry. It's quiet, and the evenings is calming down. The hotels have the, they are probably a lot of tourists, but it still is a calm situation. And every time I've been there, I've been thinking this is a beautiful place to live. But please describe now the wines you have, and in our right glass, how do you like to taste it?
Yeah, from left to right, you know. So you know, we have now two wines here, two top Grand Cru vineyards from us. You know, also top Grand Cru vineyards known from the Middle Mosel, very very famous in the left glass. You know, very famous the Grand Cru Wilner Sonnenuhr. Wilner Sonnenuhr is one of the most famous wine vineyards here in the Middle Mosel. This is a vineyard, which is based on blue slate, you know, we call it blue slate soil, because our whole area, the Mosel, had been digging for 200 million years a valley into the slate hills of the Rhineland, we call them, you know. It took them 200 million years to dig the valley for the river, you know. And now, so the slate hills of the Rhineland are between 400 and 800 meters high, you know. But the valley the Mosel had been creating in the 200 million years, you know, is the reason that we can produce wine there, because the valley protects the vineyards. The Mosel is only 100 meters above sea level, you know. And then along the steep slopes, you know, of the Mosel, we grow Riesling, you know, the grape variety Riesling, you know. And here, the Wilner Sonnenuhr is one of our most famous Grand Cru, and that means here, we have the soil here is all slate soil, blue Devonian slate. The slate is from Devonian time, 400 million years old, blue Devonian slate soil. And this vineyard has the reputation to be the most typical wine, or producing the most typical wine for the blue slate soil. It's amazing. You know what's even more amazing? We still have vineyards like these two wine vineyards, which we show now, you know, which have been never attacked by phylloxera. You know, 150 years ago, the whole European wine growing areas had been destroyed by this bug, which was schlepped in from America, destroyed all the European wine growing areas. That is very, very rare, very, very, very rare that you have any regions left in Europe, you know, which never had been attacked by phylloxera, you know, or where the phylloxera didn't destroy the wines, you know. I mean, the European wine growing areas have been saved by crafting the Vitis vinifera, the European vine, onto American rootstock, so that the roots are American and can't get detected by the phylloxera bug, you know. But we have still vines which are original, where the roots, everything is original Riesling, you know. Yeah. And for example, this vineyard here, which we are going to taste here now, the Wilner Sonnenuhr, these are 130 to 150 year old vines, you know, on their own roots. These you don't find many of these vineyards anymore left in Europe, you know, which can be that old and on their own roots, you know. So it's a very, very, very unique wine which you can drink here, you know, the Wilner Sonnenuhr, what we call GG.
Yeah.
GG is basically großes Gewächs or great growth. Yeah. So Grand Cru. So it says GG, what you see here on the on the bottle tells you.
Could be a very good thing to our listeners to see if you have a GG on the bottle. It's usually it's a higher, they are always higher quality, but it's inside the GG area. There are roots or I think it's a little bit different aspect of quality, but it's high quality.
Yeah.
But what I see in your wines is that the concentration of the Sonnenuhr, who is one of the most exciting vineyards in the world. Yes.
Yeah,
and in the middle of the vineyards is a big watch.
A big sundial.
So it's one of
Sonnenuhr,
the
sundial.
Yeah, yeah.
This sundial was donated 1842 by Jodocus Prüm, one of the pre ancestors, so basically also a great uncle of mine, you know, who donated the sundial, you know, he spent all his, he was not married, he spent all his money for charity, for donations, and he donated, on you know, the sundial 1842 to the village, because in these days people didn't have a watch. Even the church tower in Velen didn't have a clock, still today. Yeah. But that was the first time that the people could at least from morning 8 to evening 6 o'clock see the time, you know. Yeah. But as soon this sundial was built into the vineyard, which is 100% south-facing vineyard, otherwise a sundial wouldn't work, you know, which you see, it's go from 8 to 6, you know, the sun is coming out at 8 o'clock in the morning and dawns at 6 o'clock in the evening. So at least during the day, the people had the time, you know, could see the time. Yeah. And so, and this sundial, Bailey Sonnenuhr, gave the name to the vineyard then, the surrounding vineyards, you know. And yeah, and this, I mean, and these wines are already produced in this old-fashioned style. After fermentation in the traditional big oak cask, which we have, it's not barrique, the small cask as the French have. Our casks are 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 liter size. We ferment the wine, the juice, in these traditional old, big old cask, you know. Then after fermentation, if they are dry, we sulfur, we top it up. And then we leave it for 1 year or 2 years, sometimes 3 years, up to 8 years, in the barrel, on the yeast, you know, because we don't wreck it off the yeast. We leave it on the full yeast and let it ripen in the barrel, but we're topping up, you know. Every month we fill up the barrel. That's very important, you know. But we let the wine stay on the yeast to ripen very, very gentle, you know. No steering, no batonnage, only don't touch it anymore, you know. And then the wine get a really nice harmony, you know. Everything, you know, the micro-oxidation through the stave, the contact to the yeast, you know, integrates, you know, everything into, you know, the acidity and everything into the complexity of the wine. That you get a very complex wine, you know. Thing, you know, that the acidity is integrated, everything is integrated, that you get very harmonious dry wine. That is, and as more you wait, if you wait 2 years, it gets even more complex, you know. And this is what I rediscovered of the winemaking of my great-grandfather, and rediscovered it for 20 years and do it again.
And then I have to go into the price thing again, Hans, because you are doing so much investment in time, so effort to it. But still, we see that the prices for German rising in that kind of category, maybe because of the competition in Norway. But I always say that some of the GGA, and especially yours, are 200-300 kroner.
I know.
Too little.
Yes. And, I mean, you know,
what is your thoughts about this? I know that the competition in Norway are big and it's strong, and it is effort to sell every bottle and so on. But still, I say to people that buy German Riesling, buy it now, because in 10 years you will laugh at the prices. But when you see that, because you started even not so expensive, so you have done a lot of. But of course, when you see also the numbers in Norway, we are buying more expensive wine from Germany.
Yes, I know.
We like to do it, and it's important to just understand I know. Behind a bottle of Riesling is not the ordinary day to day. But you need to taste concentration, as you mentioned before, to understand it. And this is one of the, I think it's one of the references it should be. But it brings me also to the reference of the other one you have with me, that just... not so far away, there are the completely different wine in taste because of the terroir.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Tell us a bit about.
I brought these two wines, you know, by purpose, you know, because they are the most extreme, you know, terroirs. We have the typical blue slate, which is 80% of the Mosel. Middle Mosel is slate soil, the blue slate soil. But there's only one or two villages in the Middle Mosel which are not based on slate, you know.
Yeah.
This is based on very red, weathered, volcanic soil, volcanic conglomerate soil, you know. So completely different. This is blue. If you look from the distance, the vineyard looks blue because of the blue slate, you know. Here, you look from the distance, it's deep red. The whole hill, deep red, because of this weathered red volcanic soil, which is basically the lava, you know, conglomerate. Yeah.
Because
you know?
In a very old history, it's coming. The lava is coming down from
basically
the hills.
It filled the valley, you know.
Yeah.
Beneath this lava flow, you know, it basically there was a valley. It was filled up by the lava flow. You know, beneath is slate. You know.
Yeah.
And but the heat of the lava flow oxidized the blue slate into red slate, you know?
Yeah.
So left and right of the village of Erzeg, you know, where we have the lava, this red volcanic soil, red and left of the village, the blue slate is all red, you know, because it's oxidized to red slate, you know? The heat oxidized the blue slate, the iron in the blue slate to red slate, you know? Yeah. But here in the heart of the Würzgarten, you know, where we have this red volcanic soil, and that's called Würzgarten, Spice Garden. Why it's called Spice Garden? Because you have a totally different aromatic. With slate, with the blue slate, you always have the stone fruit aromas, you know?
Hmm.
You have, say, green apple, depends on the ripeness, green apple, white peach, yellow peach, sometimes apricot, you know?
More mature.
And
so,
and not more this driven, kind of fruit, you know? Fruit aromas, you know? If you have a green apple, it smells, a white peach, it smells for fruit, you know? It's very fruit-driven, you know? But here in Erzeg, you never have stone fruit. With blue slate, we always said they are based on stone fruit aromas, you know.
Yeah.
But with the volcanic soil, you never have stone fruit aroma. Here you have this kind of spicy herbal aromas, you know, and you don't. Yeah, smell them.
They are
totally different. Totally different. And you have more the herbal character here, no? And it's also a little bit slightly softer because this volcanic soil buffers the acidity more. It is by analysis the same, but with a slate, the acidity looks always a little bit more minerally driven. And here with Erzeg Würzgarten, with a volcanic soil, the acidity looks always a little bit rounder, a little bit more integrated, you know, a little more, you know, bigger. You know, wine has a little bit more, seems to be a little bit bigger in the mouth.
Yeah.
And that is the nice thing, how terroir mask a wine, how terroir, how you see it in the tasting, you know?
I think everyone who buy the two wines here, and I recommend everyone to taste.
Wine making is the same.
Yeah, and I recommend to just buy these two wines and taste them together, have it to a good meal. We have talked a lot, Amstel, and it's very nice to have you here in the podcast, but we have to end the story of your visits. But I want to hear you... your plans for the future of Lucen, of your what is the next thing you're gonna do? Is a new Villa Wolf project going on? Are there any news around?
Yes,
it is. It's coming some news.
So we had a
and we have to talk about the Jaguar.
Huh?
The
Jaguars.
Yes.
That's another passion of me. I love old Jaguars, you know, old Jaguars. I just got 3 weeks ago, I got my E-Type out of the restoration, you know.
Ah, you did?
Yeah, 65, first series, completely restored, you know. And so I didn't drove it yet because the weather is so lousy. But it was 3 years in restoration, you know, and looks fabulous, you know.
We have to go back to the wines. But
yes, sir, but we have to go back to the wines.
Yeah.
What's new? I mean, with Villa Wolf, for example, we own a monopole vineyard site there, which is called Wachenheimer Bells. And this is in Wachenheim, the village of Wachenheim, the only vineyard, you know, it's the upper part of the Resch Special, which is, pure limestone, you know. We used to do always Riesling there, you know. I mean, it was an old Riesling vineyard, you know. But, you know, I have a big passion for Pinot Noir, as you know. You know, I have a lot of Burgundies in my private cellar and so. And I thought, man, you have a vineyard there, an exclusive, vineyard, you know, monopole vineyard, which is full of limestone, you know, limestone-based vineyard, you know. I mean, limestone, we're talking about Pinot Noir, or, all the great Burgundies are made on limestone. And so, and then we started 2015 to replant the Bells, you know, the Bells to Pinot Noir. A lot of different clones, you know, in there. I mean, French clones. There's little Milrondage clones with little berries and so, you know. And the vineyard is completely converted now. It took us 3 years to convert it completely to Pinot Noir. 2017 was the first very little harvest from the first third we did. 18, 19.
So you're going into the Grand Cru level of reds.
Pinot Noir.
Pinot Noir, that's a good news.
Yeah, yes. And this is exciting. I mean, the wines are really exciting, you know. Yeah.
That's good.
And yeah. So that is
I know
the next
that your Burgundy cellar is good.
Yes, I've heard
rumors of this Burgundy cellars.
And we also in the Mosel the same, you know. But that was pure accident, you know. Yeah. 2011, I mean, that's a great story. 2011, an old wine grower offered me a vineyard in Erzgebirgsgarten, you know.
Mm.
I said, sure, I buy everything. Grand Cru, Erzgebirgsgarten, sure, if I get it offered, I buy it, you know. And because it's, for me, one of the great, really great Grand Cru vineyards, because especially that it is the different soil. So I bought it, you know. It was in January. In August, my vineyard manager came to me and said, what did you bought there? I said, what do you mean what I bought there? I bought Erzgebirgsgarten, yeah. What do you mean, you know, Erzgebirgsgarten, you know. He said, yeah, but the grapes are turning red. I said, what? What do you mean turning red, you know? Riesling? Red? Huh? He said, well, I don't know, but they're turning red. I got the impression that it's not Riesling. I said, what? No, that would be buying more Rocher, you know?
Yeah.
And having red grapes in there, yes. You know? Well, that doesn't exist. I'm buying Erzgebirgsgarten and it's not Riesling planted? I phoned the grower and said, hey, what did you sold me there? What's in there? He said, oh, that's Pinot Noir. Hey! You didn't told me. I said, you didn't ask. And so, I mean, you know, I'd so never win the lottery. Yes. I never win the lottery, you know, but I bought the only Pinot Noir vineyard in Erzig, you know.
So that's the number that you have to see what you're buying.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so in January, you can't see it. And so since 2011, I have a vineyard in Wurzgarten, you know, half a hectare, Pinot Noir, you know. And so first we started to make a Pinot Noir Rosé and made a sparkling wine out of it, you know. Kept it 8 years, keep it 8 years on the yeast before we release it, the sparkling. So we are now on vintage 2013, which we release 8 years on the yeast. But since 2018, I also produce a little bit of Pinot Noir, you know. I want to see how it works on the Mosel, you know.
Hmm.
And so we do 2-3 barrels every year. I mean, it's not much, you know, 2-3 barriques every year. High-end selection, extremely high-end selection. I mean, and it's crazy, you know. Learning by doing it.
Because you have to learn a little bit.
Yes, exactly.
We're going to end this conversation because I think it's going to last for 3 hours, if not. Yes. I have to hear about the Jaguars and your passion for Jaguars. And how many Jaguars do you have today?
I have an XK, an MK, and the E-Type.
I drove with you with the MK in the...
We have been going up to the vineyard.
In the hills,
with the
and it was exciting.
Moments.
But this passion for cars, it's something.
It's only for these. When I saw the first time the XK, you know, oh God, I don't know. I was possibly a kid or so.
Yeah.
You know, I said, oh my God, what a beautiful car, you know. The E-Type also, everybody loves E-Type.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and then I got the chance to buy an XK and then we restored it, you know, and restored it. And so, you know, because I think in these days, I wouldn't buy a Jaguar nowadays anymore.
No.
But in these days, in the 50s, you know, and until the middle of the 60s, you know, the form, you know, they have been so beautiful, you know. They, I mean, that's for me one of the most beautiful cars in these days, you know.
Yeah.
Not the new ones. You know?
But I understand that you drive that quite often.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
I drive the XK. I take it down to Burgundy. We have a new property in Puligny-Montrachet.
Yeah,
I bought half of the Vieux Château de Puligny-Montrachet, you know, half of the Chateau I bought, you know.
Yeah.
We're just in full restoration.
So you take the Jaguar down there? And,
oh, yes. Yeah. We are often, I mean, if the weather is nice, you know, not in rain and so.
Yeah.
I drove twice with the, I mean, you know, it's beautiful for the countryside, you know, the convertible.
I think it's a beautiful picture we got. Mm. But, Ernst, it was very, very, very nice to be here. I hope I will see you again soon in Norway. If not, I will come back and revisit you.
Every time, welcome.
And I will just say thank you for the knowledge of Mosel, and thank you for that you started Mosel, because many, many people around the world and here in Norway, they love your works.
That's
thank you,
Ernst. Yeah, and cheers. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Ukens vindtips med Svein en Finansavisen podcast. Programleder Svein Lindin, produsent Lars Brenden Skram, og podcast- og videoansvarlig Marius Mørk Larsen. Ansvarlig redaktør Trygve Hegdar.